You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Our guest this week is helpfully nicknamed Der Hammer. Capped 52 times for his country, he had one season with the Hammers. We'll talk about that in due course. But of course, he's also, to this day, the most high-profile footballer to ever come out as gay. 10 years ago, Thomas. Welcome to Ironcast. It's Thomas Hitzlsperger.
Thank you.
Welcome, I remember 10 years ago when you came out. 2014, I thought, this is the start of a whole new world. You're going to be the first of a long line of high-profile gay footballers to come out. Here we are 10 years on. You're still the most high-profile footballer. How do you explain that? What's happened there?
Thanks for asking as well, because it was a special time, you know, in the run-up to it. And as you just said, 10 years later, there's very few players that we know of that come out publicly. There is one player in Serie A, Jakub Janto, Czech player, plays for Cagliari. But I think he came out publicly, but after that, he sort of kept quiet. And that's his decision. That's fine. For me, it was an interesting journey. You know, I felt it was the right time to speak up and to say something publicly. And between then and now, I'm just more engaged. And I just feel like I have a duty to speak up regularly and support people, because I've been helped by a lot of people to get that far. But unfortunately, at the highest level, there aren't many players.
Yeah.
Did you get much response, much help from inside of football, like the PFA or anything like that? Did they contact you at the time?
Well, I have to admit, I never reached out to anybody, you know, before that. I just felt more comfortable talking to my family, my closest friends. They were the ones that really helped me to get that far. Afterwards, I had some lovely messages from people within the football industry. I can't explicitly say who they were, because there were so many emails and letters and social media posts and everything. It was great. The response was so positive. But at that point, I didn't need help. You know, that's why I said in the run-up to it, I needed support from family and friends, which I got. But afterwards, it was like, okay, I take the praise and everything. And now it's down to me to, you know, follow up on it.
Mm. Yeah. Well, we'll come back to that at the end of the interview. I wanted to start by asking you about Bayern Munich, which was you're from Munich, right? Did you grow up a Bayern Munich fan? You were there at the academy and got released quite early on, which is how you ended up in England.
Yeah. I'd say I was a fan for the time I played there. So 11 years I spent at the academy at Bayern. Wow. Of course, I was a Bayern fan, but I grew up in a family, they're all 1860 Munich supporters. So almost the day I left, you know, I wasn't a fan anymore. I joined Villa, really loved English football, loved Villa. And now, if there is a team in Germany I really like, apart from Stuttgart, where I played, it's 1860 Munich and not Bayern.
Wow. I was trying to figure out who you would have played with growing up. Dietmar Hamann, I think, might have been around. Philipp Lahm, no?
Yeah, Dietmar Hamann is older than me. Philipp Lahm, Bastian Schweinsteiger, they're a bit younger, but I knew them from the academy. Some other players, you probably wouldn't know them either. They're older or younger. In my age group, there isn't anybody I can think of that played other than Owen Hargreaves. He came over from Canada, you know, joined the academy at Bayern, and then later
did
came
really
over
well out there as well.
He did really well. Yeah,
really well.
It's big names. Yeah. So what was it? I mean, that's a brave decision as a young man to get released by Bayern and go, I'm going to go try and set up in England. That takes a lot of bravery.
I didn't get released. The thing was, I went to the under-17s World Cup in New Zealand at the time, and I didn't have a contract with Bayern. So I've been playing for them just without a contract, came in almost every day because I wanted to. Went to the World Cup to New Zealand, and there I met an agent. And the guy said, look, I can get you a trial in a Premier League club. And I thought, that's interesting, you know.
Yeah, quite
okay, prove
that.
It to me. So when I went back from New Zealand, he said Villa would take me on a trial for a week. So I left Bayern for a week to train with Villa. And then they said, you know, here's a contract. Wow. We want to sign you. And then I had 6 months to think about it and decided to join Villa.
Wow. Yeah. I was trying to figure out, you might have been ex-Hammers you would have played with at Villa. David James? Was David James
yeah,
there?
Yeah, David James. Yeah.
Character.
Character,
I mean, there were a lot of characters. Seriously, that first season, you know, you're young, you come from abroad and you come in. David Shinola signed that season.
Yeah.
David James was there. Gareth Barry was still young, of course. Alper Ozalan, Luke Nilis, Peter Schmeichel signed a year after. Paul Merson. I mean,
God, big
so
names.
Many big yeah. names, great characters. Gareth Southgate. And, you know, when you walk in, you think, this is big.
I was just about to say that to you. I didn't realize when I went to Villa 2009, I didn't know how big Aston Villa was. Huge club, wasn't it?
Indeed, yeah, yeah.
And there's so much. You walk in there and the European Cup's on the side, you're like, right, and the training.
Well, the
ground,
first thing they told me was the final against Bayern, Villa, Bayern, yeah. You know, because in 82, that was meant so much to them. Mm. And of course, you only realize how big the club is when you actually live there, because I came from Bayern, which is also, you know, not a small club. And it was phenomenal just to see these characters. Dion Dublin's another one where you think these guys are really, you know, grown up men and they love football. They give you a tough time in training, but at the same time, they're really decent characters.
Yeah.
And did you learn a lot in those early days playing with the older boys?
Yeah, yeah. I had huge respect. You know, you're in training, and of course, I want to get into the first team, but they didn't just, you know, let me walk into the first team and say, here's your place. You had to fight for it. And at times, to see the difference between training in Germany, where it's like you have conversations with the manager, you sort of argue with him a little bit, and there it's about tackling, you know, it's really hard. You know, tough and training, you have to fight for your place. And I had to mature very quickly. And this was the best thing that could have happened to me.
Brilliant.
Graham Taylor was the man, which feels weird to me because Graham Taylor, I always think, is a different era, like more really early 90s. But he's the man who kind of takes you out of the reserves and gives you the chance. How much do you love Graham Taylor for that?
Very much, very much. Because we have to go back because John Gregory was the first manager who was in charge when I first came. And he was... what I always say, that the first real gaffer that I've met, you know, he started watching the game in the stands in the first half, had his phone next to him. When he didn't like stuff, he picked up his phone and talked to his assistant.
I remember that.
And during the second half, he walked down and everybody was, you know, cheering him on. It was a great scenario to watch. But he always thought I was a good player, but not good enough for him. And Graham Taylor obviously believed in me and threw me in.
Brilliant. Eventually, you make your way back to the Bundesliga, to Stuttgart. And there's so many amazing goals you score there. But you know what I'm going to talk about. Yeah. Thomas wins the league for Stuttgart on the last game of the season with a volley from a corner. That is one of the greatest goals I've ever seen. And given what it means to Stuttgart and what that achievement, you must never have to buy a drink in Stuttgart ever again.
I don't think you ever scored a bad goal, though, did you?
Yeah, bro.
Every goal, like when I was playing against Thomas and seeing him play, every goal was a worldie, wasn't it?
You're almost right. Yeah, yeah. I didn't do any tap-ins.
Did no tap-ins.
No. That was great because I had such a great time in England. You know, I didn't really want to leave Villa 5 years, you know, up in Birmingham. I made a lot of friends and I enjoyed it. But then I thought with Villa, it's probably not likely we're going to win the league or even the cup. It was tough. So Stuttgart was for me the next step up. And they're a big team, just like Villa, West Ham and some other teams, but they've been underachieving. And I signed with them. And the 4.5 years I spent at Stuttgart have been brilliant. We played European football, Champions League, and we won the league. And that season just stands out in my whole career. As you said, you're always dreaming about winning stuff. And then on the final day at home, you score, you know, such a goal. It doesn't get any better than that. And I still have to buy drinks in Stuttgart, but a lot of people like me there.
People in this country have always gone about Paul Scholes' volley from a corner, which I think was against Villa, actually.
Was.
But Thomas, your goal. It's incredible. I urge everyone who's listening to this, you've got to hunt it out.
I'm going
to
be honest here, I don't think I've seen the goal. Is it straight volley from the corner?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You're further out than Paul Scholes is.
It's 20 yards. And the guy, you know, it's great delivery as well. It's all right talking about me scoring that goal, but the guy who delivers it, Pavel Pardo, a Mexican international, we practice it in training.
And it actually was planned?
It was planned, yeah.
No way.
Now, before I scored that goal, we had exactly the same situation. Corner, I had the chance to hit it and somebody, you know, deflected it. And then like 10 minutes later, same situation, the ball goes in and I just went mental.
It's very polite to mention the player taking the corner, but we can all take a corner to a certain level. It's all about the strike, surely.
Yeah, yeah.
So your nickname De Hammer, that I read, that's come from the fact you had an incredibly hard shot. Is that accurate?
It is accurate.
Have you always had that ability then?
I've had it. Yeah. I did have it. So what I did when I was a kid, you know, you immediately notice it. And that's my special ability, so to speak. So I kept on banging the ball against the wall, and you know, when I didn't have anybody to play with, I just played myself against the wall, and that was something I had, and people noticed it. And when you have that ability, I think that separates you from the rest. You've got to make the most of it. So I tried to, you know, take long distance shots, and it worked out for me.
Yeah, and with a nickname like Der Hammer, it's inevitable that you should move to West Ham.
Absolutely,
so,
yeah.
So let's talk about summer of 2010. How does the move come about? Who sells you on West Ham?
Well, this is probably a sad bit of my career. You know, I should go back to Lazio, because that was a club I played for before I came to West Ham. And that was the lowest point of my career. You know, 5 months at Lazio. I signed January 2010. Was about to go to the World Cup with Germany, and it didn't happen. So those 5 months were horrible for me. So I even thought about walking away from football. It was really that bad.
And then, injury or just not playing well?
I wasn't really injured, not physically, but mentally was tough.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, the manager that signed me got sacked after the first game I played there. The new manager wasn't interested at all. So I was stuck there and hardly anybody to talk to. And it's not their fault. I just was at the wrong place at the wrong time. And then I didn't make it to the World Cup in South Africa. So I had a really low spell. And then my agent phoned me up and said, West Ham's interested. And I thought, that can't be true, because that's sort of the only club, and going back into the Premier League and life in London, you know, of course I can mention that. The whole package, I think this is a restart for me. I want to go there. I want to prove a point that Lazio, leave it behind me. And I was so looking forward to it. I was like, yeah, that's the club I wanted to hear from. And we made it happen.
Brilliant.
And then you get injured.
Yeah.
So how does it happen? Because you sign in the summer, you don't actually make your debut until February 2011, well into the season, obviously. And by then, there's a crisis.
Yeah.
But winding back to the summer, how does that injury take place?
You know, I started pre-season, and funny enough, I went to Germany, close to where I grew up, in Chiemsee. And I had such a great pre-season. I loved every day training with the lads. The games we played, you know, it felt like, as I said before, a restart for me. I can't wait for the season to start. And then I got called up for the German national team. We had a pre-season friendly after the World Cup. Jogi Löw thought, okay, I'll bring Thomas in, show him that he's still part of the squad.
Yeah.
I was the captain that game. So we played in Copenhagen. I had to come off after 60 minutes or so. And that's when I ruptured my tendon. And it wasn't clear at the beginning, but in the end, I was out for 6 months and it was horrible. It really was.
So it was a Germany game?
It was a Germany game. My last international game, yeah.
Oh, the last game as well.
It was the last game, yeah. Wow. And so that was, at the time when it happened, it wasn't clear how severe the injury was. So at first I was told 6 to 8 weeks, and then I tried to come back. Same happened again.
Yeah.
So in total, I was out for 6 months, and I was devastated, yeah.
Was that a tough period for you? Obviously a new club, but such a long-term injury.
It was a tough, because as I said, Lazio was just behind me. I came here, arrived here, I was buzzing, I was ready to go. And then you get pulled back again and say, you're out for a long time. And that, I had so much time to really think and reflect. And that when a lot of things in my life changed, you know, sort of the personal story came into it. And I had to realize, okay, I got to make some changes in my life. But first of all, get fit and hopefully come back and play for West Ham, because I had a 3-year contract at the time and I wanted to stay for 3 years at least. But that didn't happen either.
Oh, no, we'll get on to that. Tell me about the team we had in that year. I don't think on this podcast we've really talked about it that much that particular season, but so many great players like Scott Parker. It's one of our greatest players of the modern era. Did you walk into that dressing room? I can't imagine the thought crossed your mind that this is a team that could end up getting relegated.
No, otherwise I would have had a clause in my contract firmly, and I didn't have it. So yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, Scott Parker became player of the season in a season where we got relegated, which is really bizarre. But yeah, he was great. Mark Noble, you know, I didn't know much about him at first, but he's one of those, I would say, unsung heroes. Yeah. He's a legend, which is obviously bigger. But I met people like Mark Noble at other clubs, Leon Osman at Everton, Gareth Barry at first at Villa. And, you know, what you think, what a top player. You know, he's there all the time. And every season, new players come in, but he always plays. Yeah. So that is a top quality that he has.
I think with Nobes and the players you mentioned, I don't think people realise how good Nobes was unless you play with him, play behind him. Certainly me as a centre-back, you don't. He gets, obviously, recognition from West Ham fans, but playing for England is obviously how he didn't play for England. But I think, as Thomas has mentioned, until you play with Nobes and Gareth Barry at Villa, you don't realise how good these boys are until you're in the team with them. And also what they bring off the pitch as well.
Exactly.
All big characters, all captains, I think. Everyone you mentioned, the captains do their talking on the pitch and have a massive influence on the club.
Don't always grab the headlines, but as you said, when you
7 out of 10 every week or 8 out of 10,
with them,
you know,
play with them, they're so consistent, and that's where you really see the quality of them. Matthew Upson was there, Rob Green, Demba Ba came, striker.
I was watching some highlights of the games you featured when you start coming into the team in February. We had a good run of winning some games, actually. And Demba Ba, you forget how good he was. This is the start of his journey in England. What was he like to play with?
I really enjoyed it. And we probably come to that Wigan game where he scored 2 goals and I set both of them up. But I knew him from Germany, you know, when he came to Germany at Hoffenheim. You know, the guy was just a fantastic striker. And then also a really good character, good guy to play with and be around with. And that's why, another player you really appreciate when you train and play with him, how good he was, hardworking. Everything about him was brilliant.
What do you posit as the reason? Why did that season
go so bad?
They sold
me to Aston Villa the year before.
It's a tough one. I tried to forget about it very quickly. No, seriously. And the fact that you've invited me to this, just like, why do they ask me?
We're trying to figure out what went wrong, Thomas.
11 games I played for the club, was injured most of the time, and we got relegated. And yet, you invite me to this podcast. Like, what is wrong here? And the second one I want to mention is the last game at Upton Park. The club invited all the former players. Mm. I was like, that is fantastic. And I went. Yeah. I really, really enjoyed it. But a part of me thinks, I can't go. Like, I was part of the team that went down with the club. You know, I was so embarrassed that I just didn't want to take on the invitation. So part of me said, don't go, don't go. You don't deserve it. And the other part said, this could be a memorable experience, which it was.
Yeah.
And I did go. So thank you very much for keeping in touch with me.
When you came into the team in February, we had a really good run of results. And that's, you saw, I think your first goal was against Burnley, I think it was. Yeah. And again, another screamer. And when you look at those results as you come into the team, you're having a massive impact. And I remember thinking at the time, this is it now. Because we've had West Ham many a time have pulled results together at the end of the season and got out. It happened loads of times, especially when Ginger was at the back. Thomas, did you feel like that when you came into the team and had that run? Did you think, well, we're going to stay up now?
Yeah, of course I did. I mean, because first of all, I came back from injury and I thought, you know, now's the time for me. I want to play. I loved it. I was in and around the team again. And of course, it was a difficult season, but we were still in contention to stay in the league. So why would you think that we aren't staying in the league? But the longer I played, the longer I was there, I was thinking, this is difficult. Things are not right. We have a lot of good individual players, but we just can't get it together as a team. And that was hugely frustrating because I don't have that one reason where I would say that's why we went down. There's a lot of different reasons, obviously, because we had good enough players.
Yeah. You were there that day on one of the blackest days in my experience supporting West Ham, Wigan away. I want to talk about that game for me encapsulated that season where we'd been at. We were 2-0 up against Wigan and everyone's thinking, well, here we go. The great escape's on. We somehow lose 3-2. Hmm. You were playing that day. And I remember, I think relegation might have been confirmed directly after that
game. It was. Yeah.
What was the atmosphere like in the dressing room afterwards? It must have been so tough.
Yeah. Talk about that game. You didn't mention I
set the two goals up.
From corners. You said it's so easy to do corners. So I think...
I take it it's not so easy to take a corner, but it's not as hard as the
I made it look easy.
Yeah.
And And as you said, you know, you go into the game, you have to win the game. 2-0 up, and you think it's going our way. And you're up in Wigan, it was raining. I think the entire game, it rained heavily, right? And I loved it. I just loved being on that pitch. It was going up and down. It was going our way. And you noticed the way it's going down for you. You concede, you know, 2-1, and it's an equaliser. And they scored 3-1, in extra time, didn't they?
I think the last kick of the game, like 90 minutes,
And you think, as you said, it just sums up the entire season, where you think, why did this happen? You know, we looked like we were going to win it. We had a better team. I'm saying now, we had the better team. Probably they would disagree with me. And then you lose it because of a lack of concentration, sloppiness, whatever it is.
Nerves.
And you're in that dressing room thinking, you know, this is absolute disgrace. We shouldn't be here. We shouldn't be in this dressing room being relegated. Mm. And we faced the fans. And I'm going to say this later again. Some of them even applauded us for the effort. And you think, this is English football for me. In Germany, people would just would stop us from going back home, really. It would be that bad. But some of them still applauded us for the effort. But of course, there was some swearing going on. but for me, you know, arriving here, such a big club, and the end of the season, you get relegated. It's like, I just can't believe this. And this is just so wrong for the fans. People have been loyal to us. That's why it's not good memories.
So sorry.
just pick it up again.
Yeah.
Well, look, I think if I was going to pick, I'd be interested to hear what your high point of your West Ham time is. For me, it's the game against Stoke. And your goal in particular, that you score the hardest shot, I think even harder than the one you scored for Stuttgart, into the roof of the net. And you actually see the net lift off the floor. Was that the high point for you?
Liverpool, probably.
Oh, Liverpool.
The Liverpool game.
Oh,
yeah, home game against Liverpool where we won. Should I say unexpectedly? Well, I think the club's got a good record against Liverpool. Mm. But anyway, it was a really good game against Liverpool. The Stoke one, I remember, I tried to smash the goal, you know, to score and break the crossbar as well. And that's what you could see. And it wasn't anger, but just when you know you're going to score now and you put everything in, that was it. And I was obviously delighted. I scored another one against Blackburn, which was also kind of wasn't enough to win it, but we got a draw. That was just that personal moment. But overall, it was a combination of I'm happy to be back, I'm happy to be here, and at the same time thinking, is that going to be enough for the end of the season? I don't know.
Can we talk about Avram Grant that year?
Because
we've had loads of ex-players on from that sort of time and spoke about Avram. And do you think, I don't mean this disrespectfully because I don't really know Avram, but do you think with that team we had, if there was a stronger or better manager maybe at that time, we would have stayed up with the group of players we had?
Well, you've talked to other players, I don't know what they said. I mentioned we had a good group of players, but obviously it's too easy to say it's just the manager. It can't be,
no, of course,
he can't be the only one. But we're all part of this. Mm. And I think he has to take some of the blame as much as we have to. Because sometimes you say if the manager is not doing everything or doing things not the way he should do, then a good group of players would put it right. Yeah. And we didn't. That's why I said, you know, it would be too easy for me to say it's just him. But we were all responsible. I know I saw Kevin Keane recently. Unfortunately, I didn't speak to him. I saw him from distance. I remember, you know, talking to him as well. And it was just to see his frustration. And he wanted to do as much as he could, but he couldn't really. Mm-hmm. That was devastating as well, and for everybody involved at the club to look at it thinking, we got to do something. I think we brought in some psychologists. What you do towards the end of the season when things are not going right,
try and sort it out.
We had with a team, we went away on what's it called, clay pigeon shooting or something, paintball. We
did everything,
everything. Brought in the psychologists, and you think, like, what is it that it takes for this group to really perform? And it just wasn't going to be. Like I said, everybody involved has to take the blame.
All right, West Ham fans, one way you can support Ironcast and help us rocket up the charts and beat off the competition from other official football clubs podcasts like Chelsea and like Spurs is to get a 5-star rating or review from you. Support me and Ginger on the podcast, chuck us a 5-star rating and review, and help us rocket up the charts where West Ham belong, at the top of the table. Back on with the show. I was looking, I never really understood why you left at the end of that season. I felt like you were the perfect player to kind of like help build the team around in the championship. Why did your West Ham career end that summer?
I'm probably allowed to talk about this, about my contract. Well, the club had an option to terminate my contract in case they got relegated or we got relegated, which they did. And I said, I'd like to stay, you know, because I'm happy here. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to play in the championship. I'm part of the group that went down. So I'm more than happy to do everything to get back up again. But the club decided to terminate the contract and that was it. So I thought, okay, you got to reconsider what you're doing. And that was huge frustration. So Sam Allardyce came in. Mm-hmm. He wanted his own players, which is understandable. And I wasn't part of those plans. And that's why I had to make up my mind and go elsewhere. It was really frustrating because I started to, you know, settle in, you know, even though football wasn't the best, I thought I want to have more years here and sort of hopefully finish my career at West Ham and get promoted and have a good time. But that wasn't going to be.
I can't think back to that time. Did anybody else have that in their contract at the time? Terminated it?
I can't remember. I don't know, honestly.
I know there was a big change, obviously, getting relegated, but I can't miss.
Did you have a training session with Big Sam, or was it before even Big Sam?
No, it wasn't even a discussion. It was clear, you know, club, you know, terminated contract, and then I was out of contract, and I was unemployed. First time in my career where I was just stuck here. I still lived in Shoreditch, and I thought, okay, well, what's going to happen? You know, I wouldn't choose any club. Again, you know, sort of pulled back thinking, what is my life going to be? You know, I want to be here, but the club doesn't want me to be here. What's next? And it was tough. So it
How old was you at this point, Thomas?
How old?
How old was you then? Do you remember?
I was 29, I think.
Oh, so fine. Yeah. 29. Right, right.
Yeah. But my frustration grew and I thought, you know, do I still want to be in this? You know, I've just found the club where I wanted to be for a long time, but it isn't going to be. And then I had an offer from Wolfsburg and it was a really lucrative offer. And I thought, you know, try it again. But at the time, I should have already admitted to myself, I should stop playing football because I was too many issues, too many injuries. Yeah. You know, when that big injury happened during my time here at West Ham, it was just the beginning of many injuries.
Well, I mean, you're one of the few footballers, I would say, who has a more, like, a really interesting career after you finish playing. What can we talk about? You own L'Escargot, the restaurant in Soho, one of the most oldest and famous French restaurants in the centre of London. You went on to become CEO of Stuttgart. Let's start with a French restaurant.
Well, thanks.
How does that happen?
Well, that started 10 years ago. I went in for the first time and I really loved it. There was something, sometimes, you know, you go into restaurants or places in general and you think, there is something about this that I really enjoy. I can't put my finger on it, but I really love it. So I kept going back and every time I went back, I was like, I still love it. Got to know the management. And then when COVID hit, people reached out to me and said, look, you know, would you be interested in kind of being involved in a restaurant? And I thought, I had time. I just left Stuttgart. Would I want to do that? And I thought, yeah, why not? You know, sort of becoming an entrepreneur. Can I really run a business? And because I learned a lot of stuff at Stuttgart in my role as a CEO and other different roles. So I thought that's the next step up in this industry. I love food. I love being here in London. Can I run such a big institution? It's already a big brand. So what can I do to keep it going? So I was tempted to just do it and said, how good can I be in this industry? And here I am and I love it. It's hard work, but I really enjoy it.
I wonder if you're going to get a few West Ham fans.
Well, I hope so. Yeah, all come in.
That's the plan. Yeah.
We have, there are some West Ham fans that's been there in the past and I just love telling people and I love the buzz around it when it's full up, you know. But I've been there on days when it wasn't really busy and that I want to avoid in the future going forward. So I have to think about constantly, how can we get people in? How can we make it interesting? Food is top notch. Service is great.
Selling it well, mate.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll come in. Do into that, I know it might be a bit of a funny question. Do you take anything from your time in football into how you run a restaurant, how you deal with staff, I suppose, and stuff like that?
I'd say, yeah. Mm. If you have enough time, I go back again. Yeah. Because what had a big impact on me was last year, Nobes and I, we both went to Boston Harvard Business School. I don't know whether you told
us. Together.
Yeah, we did. We didn't know, but you know, really? We all applied for it, and there we arrived, and then you get a list of all the people who are participating. There's Mark Noble. I think, is that Mark Noble from West Ham? Anyway, you know, we go into the classroom, and there he was, which was great. So we had four days together. We did all those case studies, and those 4 days were just inspirational. You know, the group of people, and how they talk about, you know, former athletes, what do they do after their career and owning businesses nowadays, you know, having a share in the business where you take more responsibility. And this had a huge impact on me. So I thought, rather than just working for a company, why don't have, you know, shares in it and own parts of the company, then I'm responsible. There's no excuses anymore. And this is, of course, it's a different industry, but I just want to run a business where I have no excuses. It's down to me whether it's a success or not. Not entirely, but I have that responsibility, and I really enjoy it.
Well, that must have had a big impact on Nobes as well. No, because he's gone on, and obviously he's still heavily involved with the club, but I think he's got a few businesses and things going on the outside as well. So maybe I should have done it.
Yeah.
it's definitely worth it. As I said, the group dynamic, people from all around the world, really inspirational guys. Clarence Tedoff was there. Those are only the footballers, but people from Google, Apple, music stars, you know, everything. And that was really inspiring.
And tell me about being CEO of Stuttgart. I thought there must have been such an advantage for you, obviously being quite clever, but having been a former footballer and understanding what the mindset of footballers did having had a career in the game really help you in that role as CEO?
I don't really know, because there aren't many CEOs in football that were former players, because it's so difficult to run a business at that size with the amount of members, 70,000 members at the time at Stuttgart, and you're overseeing the whole operation. The revenue is more than 100 million euros a year. So this is a big business, more than 300 staff. And to do that with my background is not easy, because I never went to university. You know, I didn't have the time to study all of this. How do you marketing, ticketing, merchandising? So people at the club at the time believed I have the ability to do that, you know, learn on the job, which was a huge honor for me. So I worked very hard in those 2.5 years, of course, to prove them right. And I've learned so much that I benefit every day I live now. I benefit from that experience. But there were tough moments as well, you know, and I don't think what I learned on the pitch helped me as a CEO, but you have credibility when it comes to football. As a CEO, I was also responsible for the first team and everything, so that gave me the credibility. But to learn about marketing, ticketing, and all those sort of things, I had to really dig in deep, and that was great, because I enjoy the learning process.
And now back at West Ham, looking around, I know you spent a little bit of time at the academy and seen the work that Kenny Brown's doing. What's your assessment as a former CEO?
It's looking great. It's looking really, really good. You know, the position the club's in right now, I mean, last season winning the Conference League and being eighth now in the table, that first and foremost looks great. But as I said, the people I've met in, you know, just recently, they're passionate about the club. They really want to drive the club forward. They have great ideas. I really enjoyed it. And as I said to them, when I came to the game against Freiburg, I arrive at the stadium asking them questions like, how many shops do you have around the city? How much do you pay for a beer? And how many shirts do you sell? All those sort of questions, they might be thinking, what are you on about? Why didn't you ask about the players? Yeah. But that's just having a different approach and a different perspective. For me, brings me so much. For me, it's more about deciding what do I focus on. But I love football. I really love football. So it's hard to just say, I want to be a director of football at one club, because there's so many other things in my head that whirl around that really...
You must be not surprised, but happy to see the size of the football club now from when you were playing, and certainly even from when I'm playing in the last couple of years, that obviously winning the Conference League last year has been massive, but the size of the club now, can you see a real change in that?
I can, but I also have to admit, as a player, you don't really think about the backroom staff, true. You know, all the other departments, you know, you're sort of so focused on training, on the games. You meet people at Chadwell Heath, you know, as I said, all lovely people. But on a match day, you see the people who are working there, but you don't really engage with them. You don't have sort of the imagination, how big is this club really? You get the media, you get the fans. Now, when I ask those questions, I get it. Like, this club is huge. Mm. It's massive. So how can you grow, globally, the way football has developed in the last 10 years, you know, West Ham needs to think, who do we work with? Other clubs around the world? How do we, you know, expand our fan base globally? Those are all the questions. And yeah, my impression was the club is huge.
You sound like a CEO now.
I think maybe I'm going to say our most clever guest so far.
I'm a little bit intimidated.
I just dropped the whole business school, you know.
With all due respect to Carlton Cole.
I've never mentioned him.
Good guy.
Yeah, great guy. Great guy. I'm sure almost everyone that's played with him or, you know, dealt with him, they say exactly the same. He lightens the dressing room up. You know, he can't really say anything bad about him. He's such a great character, always positive. That's what you need. You really do. And I really like him.
Always positive, but always late.
That's correct.
The latest man in football.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you as well about, I mean, so much has changed in the game since you played for West Ham, and specifically around LGBTQ inclusion. If you have a look, like, there was no rainbow laces when you were playing, and now we've got the West Ham supporters group, the LGBTQ group, Pride of Irons, which are doing fantastic work. And I understand I've been tipped off that maybe you're going to get a little bit involved with Pride of Irons.
Well, they've reached out to me. I said, you know, once I've done this podcast, we can definitely talk. Nowadays, I get a lot of requests for podcasts and especially LGBTQ podcasts associated with football. I can't really do all of them. But as I said, that's my commitment now. I'm going to speak to them. And they are one of so many fan clubs in European football or global football that have really helped the community to grow and get more awareness, which I think is phenomenal. As you said, the last 10 years, so much has happened that often people say to me, nothing has changed since I've come out. No other players or very few players have come out. I said, that's correct. But in terms of the fans and the awareness, so much has changed. Clubs really take it seriously now when they talk about diversity and inclusion. And that's down mainly to the fan clubs who have really had a really huge voice.
Have you been in contact with like the PFA maybe? Or trying to have an influence on it, as in football, players and staff members and stuff like that. Would you be interested in talking to people?
I'm working with the German FA, so I'm an ambassador for diversity with the German FA. I have spoken with the English PFA, and I'm trying to do as much as I can, but also find a balance. That's sometimes because the more you do, the more requests you get. And finding that balance for me is a tough one, because I still want to be a voice for the community. I want to be an advocate, and I want to be there, but not every day, because otherwise I'd just become just that, and that for me wouldn't be enough.
I mean, you've got quite a diverse portfolio. I wanted to ask you about this summer coming, Germany hosting a European tournament. You were in a Germany squad in 2006 that hosted a World Cup. So you know what it means for your home nation, Germany, to host the tournament. How much are you looking forward to next summer? Are Germany going to win it? But more importantly, are England going to win it?
Of course,
Is this the year for England, objectively?
Well, all those years I've lived and played in England, I thought, you know, every time a big tournament came up, England's going to win it. You know, they were so optimistic about it. And then every time they played and then it was over after the group stages or early on, you think, you know, they just talk a good game. And with Germany, it was different. But now, Germans are really concerned that this is not going to be a big success. The team's not performing. You know, the new manager, Julian Nagelsmann, hasn't really found a way to make it work. And people are nervous. In Germany, they are nervous.
Oh, really?
On the one hand, they're excited. We are excited to host another big event. You know, I'm looking forward to the whole event, but you want your own team to do well. So everybody wants to replicate that 2006 World Cup. And it's really difficult to replicate it.
You always find a way in tournaments, though, don't
you?
Germany.
We do. And I hope it's going to happen again, because all the fans, they need the team to do well. Mm. Otherwise, it's going to be a disaster, you know, in terms of the atmosphere. But I've already bought 4 tickets, 2 for the opening game, 2 for the final. I've done that.
Oh, there you go. Confident.
So I've secured them, yeah.
Wow. Thomas, just a light on that Germany, the pressure that you must feel, that Germany squad is going to feel next summer, because you were in that team, like I say, in 2006. Is that on you? Do you feel the whole nation expecting victory? And that pressure must be so different.
Yeah, it's also the run-up to it. As I said, now the players know that the fans, in the last 3 tournaments, I think they got kicked out in the group stages, so which for Germany is a disaster. So the players know it, and the expectation is rising and rising. Playing at home now, the pressure is huge. You know, I wouldn't want to be in their shoes right now. But most of these players have dealt with it for 10, 15, 20 years. I really admire them for it. But it's a tough one because looking at it, England team is better than Germany, I would say, on paper. France, definitely. Spain, possibly. We always find it difficult against Italy. So there's a lot of teams. I think we were quite fortunate with the draw, and no disrespect to Scotland, but we were quite fortunate with the draw. And once you have that momentum, right, and that's what happened in 2006 World Cup and the second game against Poland, late winner against them, that created that momentum. And we ended up playing probably a little bit better than we actually were, but that buzz that was created helped the team, and that is possible again in the next summer's Euros, and hopefully that will happen.
Same as our Wales team, 2016. Talk about momentum.
Yeah.
Like going into a tournament, and it was exactly the same. But Germany always find a way, mate.
They do, yeah.
We should have a quick word on Wales. You could still be there in 2024.
Yeah, still got a chance. Got a play, playoff game in Cardiff, and then the final in Cardiff as well. So, yeah, look, we're at a stage now where tournament football needs to be regular, and the qualifying hasn't been great. There's no doubt about it, but we still got a chance.
Yeah,
in Cardiff, take on anyone in Cardiff.
Yeah,
I'd love to see you there.
Yeah.
I'll buy you a beer.
You talk about atmospheres, Thomas. Yeah, in Cardiff when Wales are playing. Wow.
Well, Thomas, thank you for joining us. Look, there's some high points in there. Let's not deny that goal against Stoke. We'll all remember that. But thank you so much
for
joining
us. Thank you, Thomas.
And thank you for listening. We'll see you next time on Ironcast. Until then, come on, you Irons.
Podcast Network.